The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you'd like to learn more about how to support our podcast, please go to patreon.com/Kwasanim. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it all.
Guys, gals, and non-binary pals, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I'm your co-host, Annie Neller.
And today we are cutting into the 2019 sequel to the John Wick franchise, John Wick 3 Parabellum. So, yeah, it's going to be a fun one.
Yep.
Keanu Reeves, yeah. So, real fast, let's do a bit of context. I guess talk about this franchise, what we kind of think of it, how we relate to it, and, you know, just how much we love Keanu Reeves. So, Annie, if you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So, I've been kind of tracking with the franchise the whole time that it's been going, meaning that I've seen all the movies in theaters as well as at home. This is a franchise that I really enjoy a lot. I understand that there are lots of critiques of it due to its hyper-violence. But for somebody like me, who has always enjoyed stunt work, who thinks that stunt work and the choreography of fight scenes is an art form, these movies are really kind of a visual banquet for me. Not to mention the fact that the director for these movies frequently cites a lot of really super famous paintings and uses them in creative ways that just add texture and meaning to the film. I really like these. The concept itself is crazy and outlandish, but it works so well. Partly because this director has a lot of faith in actors who have been underrated in Hollywood. Keanu Reeves in particular is one of them. People called him stupid and said that he was like not capable of citing lines and like doing line readings and stuff. And, you know, Mark Dacascos in this movie was also treated the same way. But this director believes in these guys. And we can really clearly see what that investment in them as actors means and the kinds of performances that they're able to give as a result of that belief, that faith. So I have a lot of appreciation for the John Wick franchise for just a variety of reasons, also including Keanu, of course. How about you, though, Jess?
I've been a fan of Keanu Reeves since approximately 1999, which I know makes me a fake fan and is not Bill and Ted and all that, but...
Oh, I was going to say Speed, like, but Bill and Ted is also...
Oh, actually, no, you know what? I do like Speed.
Yeah.
I do like Speed.
It's a classic.
Or as it's known in French, Speed. That's right. This is the kind of quality content that we're here for at the Movie Morgue. Stealing Eddie Izzard jokes from 10 years, like 20 years ago at this point. But for real, I really enjoyed Keanu Reeves' work in general, and I felt like there was like a little bit of a slump before we got to John Wick, and he's just back on top of his game.
Yeah.
And like, I fucking loved number one. I fucking loved number two. Just this franchise is probably the most exciting action franchise for me right now.
Yeah.
And I'm 100% here for it. So, yeah.
Do you want to give it a rating since you're already talking about it?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to give this one an A-.
Okay.
This is not to say that, whereas I suppose the other two films are, you know, maybe A+, I'd have to revisit them to more properly contextualize that. The only reason I say that is just because the pacing is a little bit languid. We linger a little long on some of the fights. It doesn't feel quite as tight in some respects to the other two films. However, that is not a knock against this film. First of all, this is like being the worst Beatle, you know? Okay, bad example. John Lennon, kind of piece of shit. And okay. The Beatlemaniacs are mad at us now. We'll add them to the list. But no, it's like, it's still like the most exciting action film of the year so far for me. And it's still incredibly good, and I'm very excited for what it's doing for the, spoiler alert, franchise going forward. I'm okay with it. It's kind of like a The Last Jedi situation, or like an Infinity War situation, where it kind of depends on the subsequent film to contextualize whether what it's doing is going to work or not.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
But on the whole, I saw it twice. I want to go see it again, and I'm here for it. So yeah, A minus from Jess. What about you, Annie?
So like you, I also took the time to see this movie twice, which I think a lot of our listeners know it's not something that I typically have the time to do. But in this case, I honestly just enjoyed this movie a great deal, and I thought that there were a lot of details that I would get on a second viewing, so I went back to see it. This movie gets a solid B+ from me. The first two movies, I would say, are an A and an A+. The second film is really kind of just utterly amazing. And this film has some pacing issues. I think it also suffers from some lazy writing in parts, which we'll talk about during the rest of the episode. But overall, like you said, Jess, it's setting up some really important things that are going to go on down the road, either in a film franchise or more likely in a TV series, since that's what's been talked about over the past year. So we'll see. That grade might change if that material comes out and adds further meaning onto it. But for right now, I'm sitting at a B+.
So yeah, I guess we want to get technical then kind of go into mechanics. First of all, God, where do you even start with this one? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's so much.
I think we probably want to start with the cast, I think.
Yep.
Which seems wise, so I guess we can just go down the list. I really feel like we're actually getting a lot more complexity out of Keanu in this film than we did in some of the other ones. There's more going on, and I think it's up to how charitable you want to be with your read to say whether it's like, you know, Keanu's like doing subtle things, or if you're like going back to the early 2000s, like Keanu can't act, he just makes that same face all the time.
I hate that read. That read so much.
Yeah, I mean, and Annie, you're kind of more into the mechanics of thespianism, so like, what's your read on that?
Really? Thespianism, huh? You make it sound worse every time. I appreciate that so much. My take on Keanu is this. I think he's been critically misunderstood. I think he's unfortunately kind of been a casualty in these debates about the relative value of fine art films versus popular films, blockbuster films, action movies. He's, he tried out some of the stuff, like he tried being in Shakespeare work. He was in a Francis Ford Coppola movie, and it didn't quite feel right. They didn't know how to write for him. I got the feeling that people didn't know what to do with him. And, you know, so he got kind of pigeonholed as this low-caliber actor who could only work in action movies, which is itself just so dripping with classism and this kind of exclusionary politics that I find so much in the world of the arts, and I find it really disturbing. Keanu Reeves' acting style is, I think, a bit different, and it requires a more attentive eye in some places than a lot of film critics were giving him. When you're a film actor, so much of what you do is about dialogue and face. And he can do those things. He can give good face. He can do these really florid prose lines and carry them off very well. But I think he does some of his best acting work when it's in the body, when it's about conveying emotion through gesture and posture and movement and sound. One of the things that works so, so well in the John Wick franchise overall is the abbreviated dialogue that they give him. The lines sound ridiculous if you just read them out loud to yourself. Yeah, I think I'm back. And yet he takes that line and transforms it into a moment in the first film by adding all of this tone, all of these layers of experience that you can hear in his voice. And that's good acting work. It really is, and I think it gets overlooked when it comes to him. The last thing that I'll say about Keanu Reeves is something that I really appreciate about him, and that's that he is a giver in scenes. He's not there to steal energy or to take the spotlight and put it on himself. He is there to take the energy that other actors are giving him. He's amplifying it for them and allowing them to direct the scene, to make things more nuanced and complicated and rich. And you can see that in all of his scenes with Angelica Houston and Halle Berry, these two actresses who are at the top of their games. Angelica Houston, who is a fantastic character actress, and Halle Berry, who's done a mixture of so many different roles, everything from character acting to action films. They give him so much to work with. He absorbs it and bounces it back to them, and never once do we feel that he's trying to steal the scenes from them. He's letting them direct. He's letting them steer, and it makes the scenes richer. It makes his character more complicated and layered. And yeah, that's what I think of Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. Let's talk about Halle Berry. Is it Halle Berry or Halle Berry?
It's Halle Berry.
I keep thinking it's both ways. Halle Berry. Yeah. Okay. I love her in this. She's great. I think in terms of the script, her character is slightly pointless, but her performance is fantastic. And I love the doggies.
Oh, yeah, the doggies.
Also, the woman is 52. How the hell is she 52? She looks amazing.
Yeah, she looks amazing in this. I can't believe the amount of training that she did for this movie. Like, her workout alone would have killed me. And all the training that she did with the dogs is really pretty fantastic. The stunt work with the dogs is incredible. It's something that I've never seen before. So that was really cool. And I think also the characterization that they did for her in this movie is great. When she first comes on screen, we're basically made aware of the fact that John Wick has put her in an extremely jeopardizing position. He's jeopardized not only her life, but the life of her daughter by coming to see her. So her anger at him is completely justified. And Wick seems to kind of acknowledge this, which that's really important because I think this character could have been written as an angry black woman stereotype, which unfortunately crops up a lot in action films, but it doesn't go that way. She feels like a real person who has legitimate reasons for being pissed off at him for jeopardizing her and the safety of her daughter. So I think that was really good. The other thing I'll say is that I have mad respect for Halle Berry for giving members of the press who were being pushed out of one of the premieres an interview. Particularly for black film journalists, a lot of times what happens is they'll go to premieres and they'll be like the last people who are able to get interviews. And so people will shut them down. And she didn't allow that to happen. She gave these people an interview, and it was just really cool to see her out there supporting them and doing that. It was just a really heartening moment.
I did not hear about that. That's great. That's cool. But yeah, actually, that's one thing I want to bring up specifically with regards to Halle Berry is she's funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's one thing that this movie, I think, does very differently to the first two is it's a little bit less grim and there's a little bit of a lighter tone. There's a lot more funny to this one, which isn't a bad thing. And when she spits in the bottle, that is absolutely fucking hilarious.
It was perfect. Yeah.
Although, on the second viewing, my thought was like, oh no, someone's going to jerk off to this guy. But that's the reality of things in the internet era. So, yay. You know, you live with
the
it.
The internet. Ian McShane feels kind of a little bit more background to me this time than he did in previous films. And I'm fine with that because what he gives us is good. Like, he has some good comedic moments.
Yeah, actually, weirdly, I actually, in a way, this is one of those cases where it looks a bit like, and I know you hate the phrasing here, but I'm trying to be colloquial about okay. this, is it feels a bit like bad acting, but it plays into the narrative.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where he's like, he's a bit too gestural, he's a bit too emphatic, yeah. And then, surprise, surprise, he's betraying John.
Yeah.
So it kind of works, because there was a certain serious grimness to him in the first two films. Is, you know, he's Winston, he is Zeus, he is king on the mountain, and this is his realm, and, you know, he is the angry, stern father figure, the stoic figure. Whereas here, there's a lot more lightness to him, there's a lot more casual, like, bemusement, And it plays into what he's doing.
He feels more like his character on American Gods, where he's playing Odin, which is a much more playful father figure character, even if he is a complete jerk. And we kind of get that same energy in this role. So I'm betting that's part of what informed his performance.
Oh, absolutely. Lawrence Fishburne kills it as the Bowery King.
Just a genuine gem. So good.
Yeah, and I've liked him in the previous films. Actually, I think he was introduced in the second one, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was two that he came in.
Yeah. But there was a lot more kind of, like, cynical trickster to him in that. And here there's this kind of, like, nihilistic, like, absurdity.
Yeah.
That he's reacting to, which turns into this, like, that final shot of just his face and the anger and, like, even the sound of it, just the way he brings his cane down, the way he shakes as he's lowering himself, is just such a, like, really perfect display of rage. And I am, like, that alone excites me so much for the next movie. And please let it be a movie. I'm sorry, I want to keep watching this on the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, I also hope that there's more that we're going to get to see, because I want to see more of the Bowery King. Like, I think this is a great character. He's essentially head of a network of homeless people who are constantly overlooked. And not just overlooked, marginalized and presented as, you know, crazy, right? And so that's part of the reason why they're able to do their work in plain sight. That line that he says to Asia Kate Dillon, "I am the Bowery. I'm the people that you refuse to look at when you walk past us on the street." That is such a great moment. And he delivers it so beautifully. He's just got such a presence in this film and in the second film. I just really want to see more from Lawrence Fishburne in the series as it goes forward.
Okay, look, I'm going to say this. This plays into my Matrix theory. We'll come back to
that.
Believe me,
we
will come back to that. But no, Mark Dacascos
is a delight.
Fantastic Zero.
He is a joy to watch in this. For those of our listeners who don't know, Mark Dacascos has been in a lot of, like, D-list action movies. It's been hard at times for him to get work in some stuff. He's one of those actors who's kind of gotten typecast to the point that people call him, like, a D-list actor. What he gives us in this movie is perfection. He is so, so good in this role. He's almost like a surrogate for the audience. And there's a little bit of creep to it, but there's also this just weird ambiguity to his character. It's delightful.
Yeah, he's very, like, kind of bimodal in this. There's this, like, wonderful switch between him. First of all, his screen presence is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The way he can hold a scene with just his eyes, absolutely lovely. But also, when he... there's, like, this weird kind of, like, awkward moment where, you know, he sits on the couch next to him. He's like, you know, "Oh my God, I'm such a big fan." And, like, in a weird way, I discussed this with you previously, Annie, but I feel like in a weird way he's kind of a golem or a non-person entity in some way, because there's this weird kind of energy where he doesn't quite have, like, this internal monologue or dialogue that other people seem to.
Yeah.
Is he's just killing. He's just a revenant. He's just a golem. He is, in a way, it's very strange, and I think there's more going on that I'm hoping we'll see expand. Well, no, he's dead. But I feel like there was more beyond what was in this film, because, like, his name is never referenced. He's kind, like, there's implications of something existing beyond him, if you know what I mean.
There definitely is. Yeah. I was very happy to see him in this movie and to see him be given a role that gives him the serious treatment that he deserves as an actor and as somebody who has been a stunt professional for a while, too. Asia Kate Dillon.
Asia Kate Dillon. Amazing.
Is kind of an angel in this. Like, a scary, judgmental angel.
I mean, that's the way all angels should be.
Yeah.
But really, first of all, kudos to the film for the non-binary representation.
Yes.
I'm not sure that the this is one thing that is, like, it's just kind of like a sticking point, is just like, no, the adjudicator is never explicitly gendered, but they're also never explicitly gendered as being non-binary. So, like, I'm actually not familiar with Dylan's work before this. So I was like, I was getting that big non-binary energy, but yeah. I didn't want to speak on it without clarification. And I'm really glad, happy to see what I saw when I went to go look this up. So I think it's fair to say that the adjudicator is a non-binary character. It's just not explicit in the text, right. necessarily.
Yeah. Yep.
But God, their outfits. Oh, that one.
The glove
that one
holding
earring.
Hand? Come on. Yes.
No, so good. And that coat that they never wear, they just drape it over their shoulders, and it's so good. It is such a good look. And God, and like Market Costco's, they can hold a room yeah. with their eyes. Oh, yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It really is. They're the scary version of I would like to speak to your manager. But also they are the manager.
Yeah.
Lance Reddick as Sharon, more involved this time, and I like it.
Yeah. I like him in general. He's in this really great series that I've always kind of loved called Fringe. And it's nice to see him doing work. I think the character of Charon is one of the smartest characters at the Continental, and that really shows up in this movie.
Yeah. I love his comedic timing with regards to the guns.
Yeah.
And the whole, like, suit up, this doesn't work, come back, suit up again
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that was great.
No. Let's see. Angelica Houston as the director.
That was a wow.
Very good.
Yeah. Yep, that was a wow moment.
I think you probably have more to say about her than I do at this point, I think.
I mean, I was surprised to see her. I didn't know that she was going to be in this, and I've seen probably most of her works, like, literally most of her work. I'm a huge fan of Angelica Houston's acting work. And in this, she's giving us these... I've met women like her before. I've met women like this director before in the arts. And she was just, like, channeling a lot of that energy into this role. And I really felt that. And I really saw that. And that scene where they slice her hands is not the most gratuitous violence in the movie, but it's a profoundly affecting scene.
Is there anyone else we wanted to give particular shout outs or comment on? Because there's a lot of people in this movie. There's a lot of kind of like walk-on roles, you know, Jerome Flynn, Randall Duck Kim.
Yeah. Robin Lord Taylor is in it too. Yeah. And also, Saeed Taghmoui, who plays the elder. Taghmoui is a French Moroccan actor who has had a lot of trouble getting roles. He is often called upon when there are, and I quote, Middle Eastern Bond villain roles, and that is a very literal thing. The new Danny Boyle James Bond movie was supposed to feature him as the main villain. We'll talk about the role that he plays in this movie because it's one of, I think, the deeper problems with this particular film with regards to its playing heavily on Orientalist themes. I'm happy to see Taghmoui getting work, and I think that he does a good job with the role that he's been given, and I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah. No, he's lovely in this. I'm definitely getting shades of, like Kingdom of Heaven or Lawrence of Arabia in that. And there's some problems with, like, the whole, like, Middle Eastern Orientalist coding in this. In particular, though, like, I find Saeed less... I don't think offense... Like, the offense of his casting is less notable, I think, in this for me. Just because it's preceded by the Casablanca fight, which is much more egregious in that whole, like, oh, like, you know, here's a bunch of guys in headscarves. They're terrorists, you know? Like... It's a visual coding that to me just screams like, you know, like Counter-Strike. It's very lazy.
Very much so.
And like, it felt like a different film.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, here's John Wick and Sophia, and they're fighting a bunch of brown people in like a bazaar market square. And it's like, it didn't have the lighting that I think this series is more known for, or, and the choreography just lasted too long.
Yeah.
And so it just felt really gratuitous and just like, look at how many brown people we can kill.
Well, and we've talked about this before, Jess. In a lot of American action movies, the worst violence, the most excessive kind, is reserved for Middle Eastern antagonists. And this is because of these Orientalist tropes, these Islamophobic tropes, these xenophobic tropes, really, that Americans and Europeans have had of Muslim people, of people from the Middle East and North Africa and Turkey and Asia for a very long time. There's this idea that people from the Middle East specifically are barbarically violent, that they have to, they only respond to violence. And so there's this construction of them as bestial in a lot of American action movies. I really don't like that. I don't like the fungibility and disposability of the henchmen in John Wick 3 either. But there are some other issues to talk about here too, because this movie really uses the space of Morocco as a metaphor for corruption and a justification for why Wick needs to move against the high table. Now, obviously, there's a lot of other events that take place during the film, but very specifically, this film takes pains to present Morocco as the old world, as a place of the past, as a place of violence and exotic danger and mysticism, all of which are tropes that we know are part of Orientalism. Orientalism was kind of like a name for a group of ideas and images that Europeans came up with in the 1900s, essentially to justify colonization and war. And these are basically just like stereotypes, fictive ideas about what the Middle East is and who its people are and what their personality traits are like. Oftentimes presenting Middle Eastern folks, people from North Africa and Turkey and Asia, as being lazy and indolent, as being incapable of governing themselves, as irrational, and as located in the past. We see all of these tropes play out in John Wick 3, every single one of them. Everything from the henchman in Morocco, who is just a grinning, chuckling, menacing stereotype of a Middle Eastern man, to the city of Casablanca itself, which, while shot on location, is very obviously shot in a way that's supposed to mirror Orientalist paintings of cities like spaces like Tunisia, a lot of cities like Tangier. Morocco was also a major place where people would do paintings of it, showing people in the marketplace very typically was how this would take place. Showing people leaning up against walls, being lazy, not doing anything, all of the stereotypes that Europeans associated with the Middle East and with Africa. And then on top of that, we've got, you know, the head of the Moroccan Continental, who's a European interloper. And, you know, based on everything else that we see in the scenes about Morocco, this doesn't seem to be a commentary on colonialism. He seems to be there because the people don't seem too capable as fighters, and that's really not okay. On top of that, we also have the elder who sits above the high table, who's presented as kind of like a mystical sultan who lives in the desert, and who also likes to dismember people. This is a very classic stereotype that we find in everything from stories like A Thousand and One Nights to, you know, French colonial accounts of what life is like in North Africa. So there's a lot of stereotyping going on of the Middle East and North Africa in this film, which is really not good. The reason why I'm pointing this out is because a lot of these ideas are used by the far right now to claim that Western civilization is the opposite of the Orient. And if that sounds familiar, it's because that's what these tropes were always designed to do. Now, if your film is using ideas that the far right also deploys so that it can be hateful of and do violence to people in Africa and to Muslim people, you are complicit in that violence, and you are also complicit in spreading their ideas. I just wanted to point this out to our listeners because I think this is a very good example of how really pernicious ideas get spread in mainstream film and end up being overlooked by audiences. That doesn't mean that these ideas aren't continuing to spread through this film, and that's a really big problem. I think it's also a great example of how people who are really interested in European art sometimes have not fully done the work to understand the pernicious ideas that underpin a lot of European painting. And that's important to do, especially if your film is so aesthetically keyed into European painting and so interested in including that in the aesthetics of your storytelling.
Okay, so I think the biggest thing with this, aside from the actors, is I think probably the best thing about this one in comparison with the previous films is the sound design. The sound design is so crisp in this.
Yeah.
And you can really notice it in how things feel and how punchy they are. But I think the best contrast is the difference between, like, you know, the Combat Master 2011 or whatever that was, mm-hmm. and the big shotguns. Is just when they switch to the shotguns and the steel slugs, you feel it. It's just thump, thump, thump. It's just chunky and impactful. And to the point where, like, in the theater, like, for my second viewing, I considered taking earplugs because, like, the second half of it's when they ramp it up, it is so loud and punchy.
Yeah.
That, like, it borders on being uncomfortable.
It has a lot of bass, which I think really helps people to feel the impact of those shots. Yeah, that particularly, and then when Wick is building his own six shooter in that antique weapons space early on in the film, and we hear him shoot the gun, it sounds they got the sound for that so perfect.
Good. Oh, no, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So actually, I want to kind of dive more into thematics in this one. I feel like
that's fair.
Just gushing over the choreography is not quite as helpful in this one. There's some really good stuff, but I think just to put this, I think, in perspective and, like, do a bit of due diligence here, I think, like, Annie, what's your favorite fight scene in this one?
It's with the Shinobi twins.
Ah, damn it, you took my answer. Oh, the Shinobi twins are so good. And I also did just want to bring it back to them because we neglected to mention them.
Yeah.
That's Sisep Arif Rahman and Yayan Ruhian, mm-hmm. who are absolutely lovely in this. And I think one of the reasons I like that fight so much, and actually, Annie, you go first. You tell me why you like it before I, like, talk all over you.
I like it because it feels like they're all having fun with each other. And I know that that probably sounds weird to some of our listeners because it's obviously a fight scene. There are consequences in this scene for what happens if any of them loses, i.e. life or death. But it really feels like they're having fun doing this. It's a very playful fight scene. And, you know, the Shinobi twins are much shorter than John Wick is. And so there's a real interesting thing going on with the choreography about height differences. And as a shorter person who is fenced with a person who is much, much taller than me before, that's a real, like, legit thing to be concerned about. So I just thought that that was a really well-staged fight scene.
I agree. It's probably my favorite fight in the scene. And I'll bring up another favorite just to, you know, give us the content. But one thing that is really fantastic about it is I do feel like, on the whole, the choreography in this film, compared to the last two, is not as tight, and it doesn't, it wears out its welcome a little bit.
Yeah.
But this is the fight where that does not feel like the case. Specifically because narratively, there's not much. They're just another guardian between him and Zero and him and, you know, the throne, I guess, so to speak. So there is no real point to this fight except for the fight itself. And their comments at the beginning of the fight really prime me to indulge in the fight for the sake of the fight itself. Because they're like, hey, he's John Wick. Hey, he's slowed. And, like, their smile as they offer him hands to bring him back up and bring him back to the fight is so good. There is such joy, and there's this kind of, like, meta-narrative merging, or synergy, I guess you would call it, where, in my mind at least, and, you know, I don't want to project onto these actors, but it feels like they're, like, just so excited to be working with Keanu Reeves and just having this really amazing fight scene, and I feel that. Like, it takes me out of the film slightly, but in a way that really doesn't detract from my experience of it. And I think that's really emphasized by the fact that he does not kill them. John Wick is the Baba Yaga. He kills everyone.
Except for Common.
And the people he doesn't kill.
In the second movie. And I don't remember Common's character's name because I know Common as Common. I don't... Sorry, bud. But, yeah, I think that the Shinobi twins and Common's character from John Wick 2 are the only characters he has not killed. And there is an implication in the previous film that he doesn't kill people who are of equal strength and talent as he is, which is really kind of interesting. That's how I at least read this scene.
Yeah, okay. So the other scene that I will say that I really liked as a fight scene, and I'm going to group it as a whole, and I'm kind of cheating here, but the entire introductory act.
Okay.
Because like it's kind of like this one long extended fight scene, and the narrative stakes are fairly stable and consistent, and... You know, what's the word I'm looking for? They're the same throughout it. They're still pursuing the same objective. It's this kind of long-running fight. And so, you know, you start with Ernest, which is just this really creative open. He does this
amazing... It was amazing.
He does this amazing rendition of, like, you know, the kind of poetic giant. And it's very different, I think, to some... incarnations we've seen more commonly where it's like, you know, here's this big lumbering man. It's like he's tall, but he's lanky and he has this kind of grimness to him, which I love. It's not about raw power. It's about kind of reach and control. And first of all, killing a man with Russian folktales? What the hell?
Hey, that's good. A real thing that can happen to a person from reading Russian folktales.
Yeah. No, breaking necks is bad.
It is.
But then, you know, you get the horse chase, which is so good. And by the way,
yeah,
not much of a horse girl, mm-hmm. but I will say, watching a horse kick a fucking man's jaw off, really, just fucking hell. But I think probably more than what I like in that particular sequence within this scene is when he just turns a horse around and uses its ass to bump someone.
Yeah.
Just like, it really makes you respect and feel the weight of the animal. Which then wraps up into the chase scene on the motorcycles. The first chase scene. It's just, there's so much good stuff going on in there. It's very good. I love it. I really do.
Now that you've talked about animals, that kind of reminds me of one of the thematics in the film, which is the line between the people in this world and animals. There's a line that the adjudicator.
First of all, we have to pull down the deep cuts banner.
For that?
We have to hold up that sign. Okay, so you're talking about animals?
Oh, is this deep cuts now technically?
I think this is going to be deep cuts now because we just want to get into it.
Yeah, so I guess what I wanted to say is that there's this scene between the adjudicator and Winston that takes place in the basement, and the adjudicator says that the rules are what distinguish us from the animals. And it's just a really interesting scene because it seems to set up one of the core conflicts that's really been a part of John Wick's story arc since the beginning, right? John Wick is so much a form of narrative storytelling that's rooted in folklore, and so this seems to be an interdiction, right? This seems to be a rule that the rules themselves are what prevent us from becoming animals. And John Wick violates that interdiction multiple times, right? In a way, because he cares for animals so much, and obviously animals being a thing that is not on the same level as he is power-wise or in terms of being in this universe, like holding any form of structural power within the continental and its whole system. So I was just wondering what you thought of that. Because it does seem to be kind of at the center of the storytelling for this universe. What do you think is the deal with John Wick and animals?
I mean, not even not extending into this world. There seems to be a second layer to that transgression is, first of all, he loved an animal, which I believe to everyone in this world of shadows and assassins is kind of just an accessory, an object, an item. But also this animal that he first fought and bled and killed for was a symbol of his wife, who was a person outside of this order. So it's that he basically that he fell for a mortal, I think. There's this transgression that he has involved himself in the world outside of theirs.
Yeah.
Where everyone else seems to kind of live, breathe, and shit the Continental and the Shadows and the Assassins.
Right. Yeah.
So in a way, his crime, I think, in a way, is being mortal. Yeah. Going back to the technical note for a second, but I feel like the gunplay in this one was really good. I really do like how much less effective it was. And we'll kind of get into more of a thematic thing there, I guess. But, like, okay, I'll just get straight into this one, I think. It's really interesting. I think the gunfights in this film, and that's probably why the Casablanca sequence feels so egregious, is guns are no longer the focus. It's really strange that, you know, in this movie about, like, you know, it's made famous, I think, particularly for Reeves' new style of action with, you know, the center axis relock technique and all that, is this really tight, very technical, very tactical, very modern gunplay is divorcing itself from the gunplay as its central conceit. In a way, there's a mythology to this, and I'm going to kind of break down my thoughts, and it's not quite concrete. I haven't really prepared a statement for this. This is just rolling off the cuff, but the first film is about killing men. The first film is John Wick raging against his fellow man. The second film is John Wick entering the realm of the gods and fighting other assassins. It is about him fighting, you know, society, I guess you could call it. There's some weird stuff about that. But this film is not necessarily a rage against the heavens and the gods themselves. It is a deconstruction of the systems that create the gods. So, in a way, and, like, we can get into this really, like, classical mythology symbology here, but John Wick is bulletproof. He's been wearing the bulletproof suit since the second film. So, in a way, this is very Herculean. You know, he's wearing the Numidian lion, and he's facing the high table forces at the end, for example, are completely immune to handgun bullets, except up close. So they've taken the gun as this pinpoint precision instrument of death, point and it kills. You know, it's a vorpal sword. You point it at someone, they die. And they've slowly pulled it back to the point where it is now just another bludgeon. So, like, in a way, I feel like kind of the symbology and the axis we're looking at is guns are for killing men.
Yes.
And I think that's ultimately Winston's mistake, is that he tries to kill John Wick with a gun.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Because John Wick is not immortal, but he is also not one of the gods. He's, you know, a demigod or a hero, however you want to make that delineation. And it's not clean. This is the thing I want to be a little clear about, is this is not like this well-constructed, like, matrix of grids and clear delineations. There's a lot of blurriness. There's a lot of stuff. And there's not, like, one cultural context that this really works. And this doesn't just work in classical mythology. It's also drawing on Russian folklore. Zero himself is more of, like, you know, a samurai revenant. There's a lot of stuff going on. But we're shifting away from the gun to the sword and to the blade and to this kind of more intimate symbology, which I'm loving.
I think that's a really good point about the shift in the use of weaponry and the shift in the stories as well, right? Because what it sounds like to me is that John Wick is a kind of liminal figure. He's a figure that exists between different states, right? He's not entirely a villain. Even though he's called Baba Yaga, he has some heroic qualities to him. So he's neither antagonist nor at times protagonist, although the film wants him to be. And he also kind of fits into the hierarchy at the Continental, and yet is somehow outside of that as well, is considered more than that, is considered excess of those circles in some ways. He reminds me a lot of all these different, you know, folkloric characters that are out there. A lot of times witches, actually, which is really interesting since, again, Baba Yaga is a witch. That makes a lot of sense to me, though, because witches are very much characters that police the boundary lines. They are the ones who violate the interdictions of folkloric storytelling. And they tell us a lot about the kinds of boundaries society is trying to set out. And you and I have obviously just talked about how Wick kind of violates the rules about animals, right? Violates the rules about caring for something which can't really harm you, right? Yeah, there's just kind of a lot there. He seems like a character at the crossroads, a character that is somewhere on the boundaries of society.
So what I think is interesting about this idea of the folkloric, not necessarily a hero, but this folkloric figure, is what John Wick is not, is he doesn't actually fit into a hierarchy. Because that's one thing that, and feel free to correct me, you're the art historian here, but this is just table read right here, is this idea that folkloric monsters like the Baba Yaga, and I know maybe not the most fair characterization of the Baba Yaga, is they're folkloric legends, they're shadows, they're monsters, and in a way, they don't really exist in a proper canon the way that other things do. They are the things that you're not afraid of really on a conceptual level so much as you are on a practical level. You know, there are things that go bump in the night. They're the things that are close to you and outside of the realm of, you know, gods and monsters and all that. Is there something that has a very human element to them. And so, you know, you don't say, oh, I believe in the Baba Yaga and I do think. You say, I lay out protections because I don't want her to take my fucking kids. You know?
Yeah. I mean,
it's
Baba Yaga is the threat to the child. Yeah. It's the, if you don't eat your peas at dinner, Baba Yaga will come and get you. It's the existential threat that's also supernatural. And with Baba Yaga, too, thinking about Wick and sort of like your idea that Wick is outside of these systems, that he works within them but doesn't like fit within them in these clean ways. Baba Yaga as a witch certainly fits that very clearly, because witches cannot operate within the bounds of society. Particularly within these folkloric stories, they are about the boundaries between society and the wild. And that definitely comes in I'd say the entire franchise about Wick. It's about that balance.
Yeah, I think the thing that's also to be considered is, I feel like, you know, characters like this, like, you know, the witch and so on, are kind of not, I don't think they're sanctioned, is I think the word I'm looking for, is they exist in these mythic traditions, but the gods don't want them and the mortals certainly don't want them. They feel kind of primal in this way that they don't arise out of any kind of orthodoxy or tradition so much as they are, and you have to deal with it, and you can brush them under the rug, but they will be there
still get you.
when you least expect it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a legit read.
So let's talk about The Matrix for a moment.
Yeah.
Because this film certainly wants to.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's the thing. I have had this pet theory since John Wick 2 that this is a new Matrix. And now they're playing with these references. I was so excited for this film from the moment the first trailer came out and they said, I need guns. Lots of guns. And first of all, what a fucking callback. 20 years to make a callback like that. But like, I have so much going on in here. Like, The Matrix falls into what I'm loosely describing as a filmic tradition or canon, even though I kind of don't believe in the concept of a literary canon at this point in my life. But there's a lot going on. But it's this idea of the Gnostic prison. And in The Matrix, the Gnostic prison is society, to a certain degree. It is the prison of people. But particularly in John Wick 2, I'm looking at this as being like, you know, the seventh Matrix. And I'm seeing this as this prison being of people, of persons, of individuals, where the prison is now, it's no longer a prison of people, but a prison of the personal. where you have all these links, because what is trapping, you know, Neo or the One here is not the illusion of society. It is the illusion of, I don't even think it's fair to call it the illusion, but it is love and grief. And so it is in losing his wife, Helen, that he is reintroduced into the world. You know, in a way, if you want to go Campbellian about it, and, you know, we have our issues with John Campbell, but if you want to go Campbellian about it, his journey to the underworld is not, you know, to see the Elder and go into Hades and retrieve, you know, Orpheus and Delilah or whatever. That's not his underworld. His underworld was Helen. This underworld was peace and love and serenity. And when he comes back, he knows that the world has changed. And so in this film in particular, like, we're seeing a lot of callbacks here. You know, he's reunited with Lawrence Fishburne. We needed a Carrie Ann Moss cameo. We really did. But one thing I see, though, is especially at the end of this film, we look at this as starting up, I think, we're seeing the kind of impetus of the Gnostic prison where we must destroy this false world. Or false might be the wrong world, but the wrong word here, but, you know, it's revolution. It's open rebellion against the gods. And in a way, the Bowery King exists outside of this system. Everyone else claims a name. Zeus, Ares, the Adjudicator. They exist within this paradigm of stories and narratives and roles. And the Bowery King does not claim a name. And in a way, the Adjudicator also doesn't, which is also interesting. But in this, he is becoming, you know, Hephaestus or, you know, the devil or something. I don't want to necessarily ascribe a particular myth. No, no, not John Wick, the Bowery King.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because I don't think it really works to apply a direct, like, mythological parallel. But what he is angry, and what he is he is plotting a rebellion. He is plotting revenge. He is planning to burn down Olympus, which is just really going to be so much fun. Yeah, in a way, I think also what you see is that his entire network, the Bowery King and his kind of like hobo network, kind of exists outside the margins. Because one thing I think that we kind of saw in the second film is that they exist outside of the purview of, I guess, heroes and like demi-humans or whatever you want to call them, where a lot of the assassins were not aware of their existence, which makes, you know, John Wick kind of this bridge between worlds, because he is aware. Also, criminal underuse of Jason Mantzoukas here.
Oh, just I think he's going to be back. I legitimately think that he was introduced for a reason. People are talking about him.
I mean, he got a poster. He got a poster. Yeah. So you know there's more going on.
Oh, yeah.
And what he does do is great. TikTok, TikTok. I love it. He just, I have loved him since Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I'm aware Johnny come lately.
Yeah.
But fuck, he's good in that, and fuck, he's good in everything else I've seen him in. And he just has such a wild energy that is honestly very intimidating in this film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, he's great in this. And it's a tiny, tiny role. And he does a lot with it.
But yeah, what I find interesting, I think, is that, like I've said earlier, this is not about the destruction of the gods. This is not about, you know, Rage Against the Heavens specifically. But this is about constructing the systems and the frameworks within which they exist, because I think there's a very interesting formulation of this kind of concept of the gods going on here. And I do think it's deliberate in that we've been very specific with this series to choose our language. You know, Winston is Zeus. Charon is Charon. We had Ares. We have the Adjudicator. We have the Elder, who I think kind of serves a role of like Hades in this.
Mm.
It's this kind of weird thing where, you know, he's not going back necessarily for his wife, so to speak, but to go back to retrieve the honor or soul of his wife by deceiving Hades and pretending to give it up. It's just kind of complicated. Well, it doesn't map to the mythology necessarily.
It's kind of,
but there's a kind of, I think, thematic or like soulful parallel to it.
Yeah. But it also definitely maps with the mythology, right? Because Hades is the one who has the power to send people back into the realm of the mortals. He's like somebody who polices the boundaries. And arguably, if he's Hades, then John Wick is Thanatos, right? The actual god of death. I think that fits in there very well.
Yeah, here's the really weird thing.
Yeah.
Because when you mention that, I think a character that weirdly maps to John Wick is actually, and this is weird for me to say, I actually think it's Oedipus. Because I think what happens here is the gods do not know their son. Because when I'm thinking of Oedipus, I'm not speaking like, you know, it's not John Wick wants to fuck his mom. That's ridiculous. But it's the fact that, you know, he comes and he is not known for the kind of destructive power that he represents. The doom that he represents is John Wick is here. John Wick is the power that will end the gods. And the gods, their mistake is not treating him with the gravity that he deserves, I think. Because, you know, like, that's the thing, like, we get twisted up in kind of the specific details of the Oedipus myth. You know, we turn it to, you know, an Oedipus complex. We look at, oh, it's the man with the sandal. It's the, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think what we kind of lose in our kind of modern colloquial discussion of the myth is the fact that one of the core aspects of the Oedipus myth is the warning not heed, the warning forgotten, the warning not heeded. Because the warning is heeded, you know, your son will kill you. Okay, we get rid of all our sons. We're done here. And so it's kind of the inversion of, you know, you have forgotten the face of your father, is you have forgotten your son, in a way. Because there is this very, and I find this fascinating, because there is this very kind of paternalistic or, you know, maternalistic relationship that John Wick has with all of these authority figures. Zeus treats him like a kind of like elder, kind of fatherly friend. The Bowery King treats him like a child. And this whole thing with Angelica Houston is, well, it's Angelica Houston, like, it's the lost child. There is a lot going on here. And I think, you know, John Wick is the prodigal son of this system of assassins. And they're trying to treat him like a normal assassin, which is why everything is exploding. Yeah. I think, in a way, John Wick specifically is allowed to break the rules. And I think that's the fact that they don't respect. Because, I hate this, because in a way it kind of makes him, you know, the hero of destiny and the chosen one. But at the same time, it kind of tracks is, for anyone else, breaking the rules means death. For John Wick, breaking the rules means the universe will stretch. And in places it will break. And I think that's kind of like this narrative looseness that we're seeing in this film, is we're kind of expanding beyond the scope of, you know, the Matrix, is we're seeing this wider, like, flowering of the universe to accommodate the fiction. And in a way, it feels almost ad-libbed and improvised, but in a way that has this dreamlike quality that honestly plays well for me.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So this is kind of what I'm thinking with this one is, I do think it's kind of the weakest one in the series for a couple of different reasons, which is not to say it's bad. It's, you know, it's still a fantastic movie. But what I'm really hoping for is, it's like Endgame. I want to see what comes next. Because this film does not focus internally within itself. It doesn't look to tell a complete story and bring us a satisfying resolution within itself. What this film does is it sets up for a sequel. So the question becomes, when that sequel comes, does it live up to what we've seen here and enhance it and elevate it? Or does it disappoint and thus make all this time and investment we've spent in this film building up to that feel like a waste and anticlimax? And really, only time will tell, because like Endgame, this is an incomplete film. And in a way, that's kind of disappointing, but until that, you know, waveform is collapsed, until the superposition is gone and we kill Schrodinger's cat and we don't know, until we know whether the next film is good or bad, whether it elevates, whether it moves up to this, it's still, I think, to a degree exciting. But I want to see it do better, and I want to see that excitement. I want this series to live up to its potential, because it's fantastic stuff. So ultimately, I guess we just want to see where it goes next, because...
Oh, yeah. I don't... Where is this going?
This is a weird... This is that awkward step, I think.
Yeah.
Is this the top of the stairs or the bottom of the stairs where you expect there to be one more step and there isn't?
Mm-hmm.
And either your foot meets something early or your foot doesn't find something where it expects something to be.
Yep.
And you stumble. And here's the thing. That can end in disaster, or that can be just kind of this like dip before you rise back up and find something up. And we're not going to know what that is until we see what's next in this franchise. Anyways, this has been The Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I've been your host, Jess Whitmore. You guys can follow me on Twitter and twitch.tv at Quasinym. That's Quasinym. I play video games, I talk about angry leftist stuff, and I talk about movies sometimes. Sometimes. How about you, Annie? Where can people find you and yours?
People can always find me on Twitter at Lights and Music. That's Lights, E-N, Music, all one word, no caps. And I talk about art and my dog and stuff.
Yeah, and you guys can find us on Twitter at MovieMorgueCast, on iTunes at the same, on Facebook at MovieMorguePodcast, and so on and so forth. And if you guys like what you hear here and you want to support the show, couple things. One, thank you. You guys are always listening. We're grateful. We can't do this without you. Second of all, tell your friends, review us on Facebook or iTunes, all this good stuff. And if you want to take it a step further and help us keep the lights on and also get some juicy bonus episodes, we do have a Patreon at patreon.com/quasinym. That's the same as my Twitch and Twitter, where, you know, for pennies a day, you get bonus content and help us keep the lights on and the server costs. Anyways, we love you all so much. Our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factopus. And watch out for the Baba Yaga, y'all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.